Well, thank you so much for that very, very warm welcome. It's a real pleasure to be with you here at the National Farmers Union annual meeting. And Roger, thank you for that kind introduction. And I do remember those days, and you didn't make a mistake supporting me, but it's the way it is in politics, you know? I checked my hands, they're big enough. My ears aren't too large. Now, there's a lot of humor this year. You heard the one about the two Corinthians that went into the bar? You can't make this stuff up, believe me. I just came back from Dubai, and they are, people abroad cannot believe it. They are so, they're not amused, actually. They're frightened because, you know, all over the world, people depend on the President of the United States. The decisions the President of the United States can make about the economy are relatively limited. Occasionally, he gets to hire the or recommend the Federal Reserve Chairman, and they have meetings. And he picks the Treasury Secretary if Congress will approve him. But he's really not actually hiring people. He's not setting the interest rate. He's not really handling the nation's money supply. He's not putting projects in. And as much as President calls for infrastructure programs, he can't actually pass them. But where the President makes a huge difference is on foreign policy. And people all over the world are dependent on the good common sense, the experience, the judgment of the President of the United States. And so it is, it's an important issue. It hasn't received all of the attention that it will in this election cycle yet. But it will receive, it will eventually dominate this election cycle. I really do believe that, despite all of the issues on the table. And I'd like to talk a little about that today because you all are right in the middle of it. You probably don't realize it on a day-by-day basis, but what you're doing through the National Farmers Union, in your individual businesses, in your states, you are a key ingredient of U.S. foreign policy, and you have a key voice in U.S. national security. So I want to talk about it. Now, Roger indicated that, you know, I did go to West Point. I left Little Rock. I was 17 years old. I went to West Point. It was a time when America was under threat in the Cold War. Nikita Khrushchev had come to a farm in Iowa in 1959, said he'd bury us. In 1960, in the presidential campaign, it was all about the missile gap. People were afraid because for the first time there were intercontinental ballistic missiles, and there was a draft, and people were patriotic. And in my part of the country, that meant you served. If you went to the University of Arkansas, you went to ROTC. And if you didn't go to the university, your chances are pretty good you're going to get drafted. And so I talked about it with folks at my high school, and I heard about West Point, and I wanted to go to West Point for a great education and for public service and to be in the United States Armed Forces. So it worked out. I made it. And it was a great experience. And I'm proud of my service. And I'm proud of all of our veterans. And I'd like to ask you, if you serve this country in uniform, would you just raise your hand so we can recognize you here, please? Look at that. That's patriotism and that's service. I thank you for that. Thank you very much for that. Well, I got out of the military. It was a great experience, and I got out in 2000. And as Roger indicated, I did get drafted. But I've been in the business community. I always dreamed that somehow I could be in business. I didn't grow up on a farm, so I didn't know how to become a farmer. Roger told me his trick. He says it's real easy. You just get the government to buy you a farm, which they used to do. But I didn't know that. So I went into this dreaded industry called banking. It was like this. You know, I figured if you wanted to be on a football team, you better know how to handle a football. And if you were in the military, you needed to be infantry or armor. I was armor. And so if you were in business, you needed to understand money. And that's about banking. So I became a banker. I've been in more than 80 different businesses as either the chairman, a member of the board, an advisor, or a consultant. I've been in energy, oil, gas, wind, solar, biofuels. I've been in security companies, training, strategic advice, cybersecurity, network security. I've been in finance. I've been with Goldman Sachs as a consultant to their private equity. I've been with Clayton, Dubilier & Rice. So I know all those bad boys in New York on Wall Street. I know all the one-tenth of one percenters up there. But I've also been all over the country in multiple businesses. And so just got back from Dubai. I've been in Estonia, France, met with the president of Zambia a couple of weeks ago. I do business in Africa. So I've seen a lot of the world, and that's what I want to share for a few minutes and then take your questions. And I want to talk about where we are in this country from national security and from the economy. Look, back in the 1950s, when America had come out of World War II, we were the most productive country in the world, we had the largest economy in the world, and we were really unchallenged, despite Khrushchev and the others. We had nuclear weapons and we had energy. We were an oil exporting country, and we had a monopoly on nuclear weapons in the 1940s. 49, Russia copied us, got their first A-bomb, but we were way ahead during that period. Over the period of the Cold War, every president followed the strategy of General Eisenhower. He enunciated his strategy in his inauguration speech, and he put it like this. He said, "We're looking abroad. The Korean War was going on. Stalin was threatening Europe." He said, "We've seen evil out there." He meant communism. He said, "And Republicans and Democrats, they don't agree on everything." He said, "But we have to work together to secure America's future beyond our borders." And that's been America's strategy. That was a strategy for 40 years of the Cold War. Democrats and Republican presidents, they all had a little bit different view on things, but Congress and the American people came together because it was national security. And when the Cold War ended, we lost our strategy. I was a one-star general. I was commanding the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, and there was a German general. He'd come over, the U.S. Forces Command said, "You're going to host Brigadier General," I forget his last name, Varner or something like this, at Fort Irwin. He's got an important message for you. He comes out, we have a dinner for him. He said, 1990, he said, "The Cold War is over and Germany will be unified and the Soviet forces will leave Germany." People like me, I couldn't believe it. I went to Germany the first time in 1964. I went through Checkpoint Charlie. I saw East Berlin. I went down Karl Marx Strasse. When I was a major in the 1970s, I was in Germany as the operations officer of a tank battalion. We had a defensive position north of Nuremberg. It was right on the border with East Germany. If the so-called balloon went up and we knew that we could be attacked with as little as 2 to 4 hours notice by East German divisions that had their tank ammunition uploaded, the officers were sleeping in the barracks with the troops. It only took a signal, and we would have been at war. We reconned and prepared those defensive positions. We met with the local townspeople. They used to come out and give schnapps to our soldiers at night. I mean, they were right. They had their farms. They had their lives, and Germany had been divided, and we never thought it would end, and they didn't either. I was there as a cadet in 1964, as a major in 1976, 77, 78. I came back as a colonel commanding a brigade. I had a brigade's worth of tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles pre-positioned in northern Germany to block the main thrust in the late 80s. And then, poof, it was over. And when we won the Cold War, we lost our strategy. That German officer came through the National Training Center after he said the Cold War was over, and we're all like, "Well, what are we doing here? We're in uniform, we're training to fight the Soviets. There's no threat." I mean, Gorbachev's walking down the street in Washington and people are stopping and patting him on the back. Why are we out there training to fight the Soviet Union? And so the Cold War was over, and we entered the 1990s with no national security strategy. It was a great decade for America. We took advantage of a global opening of trade, the NAFTA, the World Trade Organization. China came online. Mexico. We had communications. Suddenly, everybody was surfing the internet. If you'd said that in 1988, people would have said, what is that, some kind of a line from Laugh-In or something? But by 1995, everybody was surfing. They had computers, and people were using cell phones. Started out as something about the size of a lunch pail that weighed about 20 pounds and ended up with something like a flip top that you could stick in your pocket. Almost overnight, the world changed. We created 22 million jobs in America. And we did deploy military forces. We put them in Bosnia for peacekeeping, and we bombed the Serbs for 78 days to get the peace in Kosovo out of that. We deployed some troops to Africa. But by and large, it was a time of incredible opportunity and peace and growth for America. People said it was the future. We were the only superpower, and no one could imagine anything different. The economy boomed, and people loved our investment bankers. Goldman Sachs was like the Vatican or something in those days. If you said, I'm at Goldman Sachs, people thought you were like a saint. You know, people from all over the world say, how does Goldman Sachs do it? Silicon Valley, amazing. And then everything changed with 9/11. Suddenly we were struck, and as Colin Powell said, it was an act of war. And we went to war. Within 30, 40 days, we were bombing in Afghanistan. We didn't get Osama bin Laden, but we did take down the government. We ended up putting U.S. troops in. And really, from the very first day we went into Afghanistan, from the first day of 9/11, Secretary Rumsfeld was asking the White House, is this the excuse we need to attack and invade Iraq? And so from the very beginning, we were planning to go after Saddam Hussein. So you know how it ends. We did get rid of Osama bin Laden. Took a few years, May of 2011, President George W. Bush said he wanted him dead or alive. We got him dead almost 10 years later. We've lost over 2,000 troops in Afghanistan, cost us $1 billion. We got rid of Saddam Hussein, evil man that he was. That's about another $2 billion, 5,000 troops, 25,000 wounded. Not sure it was worth it. There was no WMD there, but we sure did change the region. And so if you look around now at all that's going on in the Middle East, most of it goes back to that decision to invade and change Iraq. And we've tried to pull back. We recognize that this is like a recipe for endless war. You can't sort these people out. They all look alike. We don't speak any of the languages. They have their own customs. They have differences between each other. And in that part of the world, people kill each other. They don't sue each other. They kill each other. And it's a serious business. And so we don't really want to be there. They treat us as infidels. And they don't even consider us, you know, human like they are. So what's going on right now is a lot of people are confused. There's no harder operation in military science than to execute a withdrawal. And when the President of the United States is trying to reorient U.S. foreign policy and pull us out of a war, you can just imagine lots of people get confused, people like Putin. Putin thought that we were coming out, so he figured he had a big opportunity. First, he schnockered us in Syria, and persuaded Bashar Assad there to sort of give up some chemical weapons. We're not sure we got them all out, but he gave up some. And then Putin took a look at it and said, you know, I don't like that Barack Obama. I'm going to take advantage of Ukraine. And he basically seized Crimea in violation of international law, started a war in Ukraine. We tried to fend it off without escalation. The Ukrainians have lost about 10,000 people in that operation. There's no telling how many Russian soldiers were killed. I made 8 trips over there, and I can tell you that that war in Ukraine was real warfare. Flamethrowers, massed artillery, people sneaking across lines and cutting throats at night. They may all speak the same language. They may all have been one country once, but it is ugly and it is vicious. And then there was ISIS. ISIS, which sort of came out of nowhere like a Frankenstein. They were going to free up Syria with good jihadis, and weapons started flowing in, and suddenly out of it emerges ISIS, which targets Americans. And I guess they figured that since we're coming out of the region, we're no threat to them. They don't get it. We're certainly a threat. And then there's the Saudis, who have been supporting us all this time in U.S. foreign policy and working behind the scenes to support Israel. But they're afraid. They're afraid that the Americans are coming out and going to leave them hostage to Iran, which outnumbers them 2-1 and has a real economy. And they know that they are the target of the Iranians. There's fighting in Yemen. There's subversion in Bahrain. And there's an effort by the Iranians to surround and cut off the Saudis and isolate them there and then go after them. So, and then there's the Iranians, who figured they had us over the, all they had to do was threaten nuclear weapons, and then what were we going to do about it? Well, we could start another war, or we could negotiate. And I don't know if you've ever gone into one of these carpet stores where it says, going out of business sale. And you go in there, and somehow you go back home, you've got the rug rolled up in your truck, and or in your trunk of your car, and you think, I've got a really great deal. And you go home, and your neighbor says, oh, yeah, I did that last year, same store. They are expert negotiators, and they've done a good job on us. And then there's the Europeans. The Europeans themselves don't understand exactly what's happening, and they're dealing with a migrant crisis of millions of people wanting to escape these war-torn areas and get into Europe, and they're looking for U.S. leadership, and the United States is saying, well, look, I mean, we're dealing with our own immigration problem here, and why don't you deal with your problem? I mean, we're willing to help, but what's your game plan? And they're struggling over there. So that's where we are right now. And if you go back and say, well, what happened? How did we get here? The honest truth is, it's all about oil. Yes, oil. America's great strength in the first half of the 20th century. We were the world's principal oil exporting country. It made America great. John D. Rockefeller exploited it, set it up, worked it, built Standard Oil. Churchill finally caught on and started British Petroleum. And they switched the British fleet from coal to oil. And we developed automobiles and airplanes and jets and everything, plastics. Plastics, young man. I mean, everything seemed to depend on oil. And yet we were running out. We became an oil importing country in 1971. We let the Shah of Iran bamboozle us into raising the prices. We then got stuck in the Arab-Israeli conflict of 1973, and there was an oil embargo on us from some of the Mideast producers. We messed with this until finally the Shah of Iran was overthrown, and we became completely dependent on the Saudis for security. This situation went back and forth in the 1980s. We looked at alternative energy, but every time you got serious about it, the Saudis lowered the price of oil again and put everybody out of business. We were making fuel from coal up in Minnesota or North Dakota. We've been through 2 cycles of that, the sort of German sin fuels. We started the ethanol business up again. We called it gasohol back in the 1970s. And people knew how to do that because American farmers had been doing that for generations, just on their own. So had American bootleggers been doing it. There's a way to make alcohol from most anything if you care enough about it. So, but the trouble was the price kept getting caught up, and you couldn't talk your way against the economics of it. And so oil went down to $12 a barrel in the late 1990s. $12 a barrel, that was it, you know. Every time I was in the military, and what was our military mission after the fall of the Soviet Union? Secure access to energy. Why? Because oil was the most fundamental element of world trade and world economic health. All you had to do was double the price of oil to send the world into a recession. And nobody could imagine there'd ever be a glut because all the scientists were predicting peak oil, limited resources. And so people were worried about this, and that's why we were prepared to work it. In fact, if you look at why we fought in the Middle East, it was all about oil. 1990-91, Dick Cheney, Secretary of Defense, went to the Saudi king and said, King, we want to protect the oil resources because you're so important to us. Osama bin Laden looked at 500,000 American troops in the Holy Land, troops that were infidels, and said, ooh, I can raise money off this and build an army off this. And he built al-Qaeda off the presence of U.S. air power and ground troops stationed in Saudi Arabia. We knew he was a thug and a terrorist and so forth, but we made efforts to sort of get him and run him out of town. It wasn't a matter of war until he struck us on 9/11. 2003, well, look, the administration was a lot smarter than to admit that that was about oil, but the truth was, and it is, that Iraq actually has as much, maybe more oil than Saudi Arabia. Most of it's in the south that's been explored, but there are many, many, let's call them structures, some 73 structures that have not been explored in Iraq that we know of, and the odds of finding oil in commercially exploitable quantities are better than 3 out of 4 in every one of those structures. And so Iraq was a huge, ripe plum waiting to be seized. And I know Secretary Wolfowitz and others thought there was an undercurrent. We're going to invade Iraq, we're going to get rid of Saddam, and they'll pay us in oil. It was always about oil. And ladies and gentlemen, I just want to ask you this. Isn't it time to stop that? Can't we get off that? How many more U.S. troops do we need to send abroad before the nation wakes up and says, you can't run foreign policy based on the price of a barrel of oil? It doesn't work. So today, oil is, this morning I checked, it was like $34, $35 a barrel, West Texas Intermediate crude. Maybe it'll hit $40. Latest news is that they're speculating that it might go to $50. Well, in the process, people are saying, now we don't need biofuels. Now we don't need alternative energy. There's no peak oil. There's plenty of oil. Just turn it over to industry. Ladies and gentlemen, energy policy is national security policy. The most effective piece of legislation on energy that we ever put in the United States Congress and that ever passed into law was the Energy Security Act of 2005 and modified in 2007. It created the renewable fuel standard. It said that by 2022, we should have 36 billion gallons annually of renewable fuels. That's corn-based ethanol, cellulosic ethanol, and biodiesel in the nation's fuel supply. And it set a pathway for us to get there. Ladies and gentlemen, we need your support. We've got to keep the renewable fuel standard in place and make it happen. happen. Believe you me, it's under attack. I think Tom Vilsack might have said a little about it this morning, but you can't protect it through the executive branch. As good as a man as Tom Vilsack is, and he's an outstanding leader, great Secretary of Agriculture, and I think most of you here agree with me on that. I love him. I've known him for years, ever since I first went to Iowa in 2003. I think Tom Vilsack's great, but he can't protect this for us alone. Here's the truth behind this. Corn-based ethanol is a greener, cleaner fuel than gasoline. It's good for the environment. It's generally cheaper than gasoline, and it lowers the price. It reduces the harmful emissions from gasoline, so it's healthier than gasoline. When it spills, it doesn't clog up the bottom of the ocean or ruin the stream bed. It's just alcohol, and it just washes away, and that's the end of it. It's denatured, so you can't drink it. But it's just alcohol, and we need it. Now, when you start cutting in against the oil industry, you're dealing with the most powerful industry in the history of mankind. Really, it's the most powerful industry in the history of mankind. The largest commodity in trade is what? Oil. Ships are built to carry it. That's the greatest number of ships in the world. Greatest investments in infrastructure are about oil. It's the most powerful political industry in the world. And they don't like it when we put in the renewable fuel standard. It wasn't so bad when we weren't going anywhere with it, but as we begin to bring in cellulosic ethanol, as we bump up against E10 and hit the blend wall, we're cutting into their marketing share. And so what I found in 1,800 businesses I've been associated with and 15 years in the economy is that basically if you got money, you can buy just about any kind of academic study you want. And they bought a bunch of them. No, really, it's true. It's true. And they go through, the oil industry goes through the back door. You'll see an environmental group that'll say, oh, ethanol's dirty. Where'd they get their figures? More importantly, where'd they get their contributions? And you've got to take this apart. You've got to treat this really seriously. This is the future for American, not only energy, but also agriculture. We're setting, for the first time, a long-range strategy for this country. If we can stay with the renewable fuel standard, we will beat the Saudis, the Russians, the Iranians, or anybody else who tries to manipulate this country. We'll put our own energy policy in place. And I'm not saying that we should never send our troops abroad to protect U.S. national security. But what I am saying is, I don't want my grandchildren going out there to fight for someone else's oil. And neither do you. Ladies and gentlemen, this battle for RFS goes on every day on the Hill. The money's changing hands in Washington. And I want you to help us on this. This is something you can help with in your communities. There are people who have influence in Washington. You have some, but so do others. You've got to combat the myths of the attacks on ethanol. Look, the facts are clear. Cleaner, greener, cheaper, better, can build more efficient automobiles with higher contents of ethanol in the fuel. It's that simple. We'll give you all the information, but you've got to have a voice in your community and say it. And you've got to reach out to the opinion makers in Washington, and you've got to tell them, no compromise on this. The oil industry will find plenty of ways to make money without coming after ethanol, but they will not find ways to keep America safe and secure and our troops at home. That's up to us and up to you. So, ladies and gentlemen, we really need your help on this. This is about America's future. You're not just farmers. You're in the national security business. We need you out there on the front lines protecting America's economic future. Thank you. And we're going to take it.